So what I want to talk about tonight are origins. If you remember the topics that were, I don't know if you saw the list of 10 topics on things that all Christians should be able to give answers to. But one of those questions is the origin. Primarily it talks about the origin of the universe. Where did it come from? But I wanted to broaden things a little bit, because origins is really important, because the primary question is, why is there something rather than nothing? Why are we here? But that's not the kind of question you're going to run into if you're out trying to make new contacts and stuff. It is very unusual if you go up to the person next to you in the line at Target and say, "Hi, I was just wondering, did you ever have any thoughts about where the universe came from?" and start a conversation. You know, that's not generally how you're going to get into talking about spiritual things with somebody. You're not going to start there. That's not going to be where you go. The issues that are most likely to start conversations are someone struggling with, why is there suffering in the world? Why did this happen to me? Those can be great opportunities to talk to people about the Lord. So this whole issue about origins is not something that the average person is going to jump into and want desperately to understand before they'll think about the Lord. But it's something that, as Christians, we really need to be able to understand, because it tells us that science, that studying the universe, gives us better and better and better reasons to believe that the scriptures are true. Because more and more, science is backing up what the Bible has said for thousands of years. Now, the way I'm going to lay this out is not as if I'm talking to Christians. Because if you're a Christian, you already know who the Creator is. You already know the origin of the universe, the origin of life. God did it. And that's the end of the discussion in that sense. Because we already know that God did it. Now, how God chose to do His creative acts is another story. How God chose to create the universe, whether He created it in 7 days or created it in 12 billion years or whatever, that's an internal discussion. Because the major issue of where did the universe come from is settled. If you're a Christian, God did it. And that goes for origin of life, etc., etc. God did it. And then what we're doing, if we're talking to Christians, is discussing how much can we learn and understand about how God did this amazing thing. But we don't step back and wonder whether God did it. We already have the answer. So what I'm going to talk about is a little bit of how non-Christians look at these issues, and a little bit of the challenges that science has with the explanations that non-Christians give. I don't know if you can read it, Carl Sagan. Up here, there are some things that hydrogen atoms can do given 15 billion years of stellar evolution. Carl Sagan, atheist, who obviously does not believe in God, does not have any room for God in his view of the universe, says, "Look, you give me hydrogen atoms and you give me 15 billion years and I'll give you a universe full of living creatures." Well, how valid is that from a scientific standpoint? How valid is that premise? Well, let's take a look. So, I'm going to try and talk about four areas of origin that science struggles with. Four different areas. One of them is the origin of the universe. Why is there something rather than nothing? Because it is much more likely that there's going to be nothing than there is that there's going to be this incredible universe that we're in. So we're going to talk about that. How does science answer the question, why is there something rather than nothing? The second area is the origin of life. How do you start with a rock and get a person? How does that happen? What does science have to say? Life from non-life. That is a big question. Origin of humanity. Where did people come from? And what makes us different from dogs and cats and alligators? Where did we come from? What does science have to say about that? And what is the Christian response to what science has to say? Evolution very clearly says, hey, we evolved from ape-like creatures. But what's the evidence? What do they really say? And last, and this is one that I got to admit, I wish I understood better, but there are a lot of researchers that I've been starting to look at who say that this issue, the origin of mind, where did we learn to ask why? Where did we learn to dream? Where did we learn to think about thinking? How does that come from a purely naturalistic approach to life? Where does that come from? In fact, some people that I've been looking at have been arguing that of all of the arguments for the existence of God, this one is the most powerful and the one that science is least prepared to give any sort of intelligent answer to. So, if you don't get anything else out of what I say tonight, I want you to come away with the feeling that you don't have anything to be ashamed of. You don't have any worries. If someone asks you questions about Christianity or challenges the validity of the Christian worldview, you might not have the answer to their question, but rest assured, there are good answers to every objection that people have raised to the Christian faith. You don't have anything to worry about. Now, no one person is going to have all the answers. And it is perfectly legitimate to say, I don't know, because you don't have all the facts. That's cool. But you don't stop there. You want to say, I don't know, followed by, but I can find out, or I can point you to somebody who has an answer. Because Christianity has answers to all of this stuff. Now, I'm going to go back through those four in more detail. And at this point, if you have questions about what I'm saying, please ask. If not, it's going to be kind of dry because I'm just going to go through here and you may have questions that you didn't raise and I may say things that don't make sense. So please, if you have questions, stop me. Wait for the microphone. Where's our microphone runners? So that we can get the questions recorded as well as the answers and so that we can make this a bit interactive here. Because if there's no questions, I'm just going to go. And that may or may not be a good thing to do. So, how do you get something from nothing? That is the principal question for the origin of the universe. Well, two options. It either has been around forever, which means it's eternal, and which means, well, then it never had a beginning, so it's always been here. The only other option is that it had a beginning. So, let's assume it's eternal. Now, by the way, whether the universe is eternal or not is not really a scientific question, it's a philosophical question. So you can't ask a scientist if it's been here forever. But you can ask a philosopher. And philosophers have shown that the universe that we live in cannot be eternal. It cannot have been here forever. Now, it's a simple, there's a lot of different reasons that philosophers give and a lot of very complicated, convoluted logic, but there's one that's really simple. And that's this one. If the universe has existed forever, the universe that we're in, everything would already have happened. However, everything has not already happened because I haven't yet clicked to the next slide. Okay? Everything has not yet happened in the universe. So the universe that we're in cannot have been here forever. Now, there's a whole bunch of arguments behind that that explain why that's true. And we can talk about those if you want, but if there's no questions on that, we will continue on because there's a lot of stuff that you may be curious about in the future. But if it's eternal, everything would have already happened, but it hasn't. Therefore, the universe cannot have been here forever. So, let's assume it had a beginning. Anything that begins to exist has a cause. That's pure, straightforward logic. Anything that begins to exist has a cause. That is, something can't cause itself. Something has to make things happen. Things don't just magically happen. One physicist who talks about this says, no, that's not true. Some things can begin to exist. He says, things can just pop into existence whenever. And so he was asked, have you ever seen anything just pop into existence? Well, No. Have you ever heard of anyone who's seen anything pop into existence? Well, no. Have you ever seen any reference anywhere to something just popping into existence that wasn't a fairy tale? Well, no. Do you have any scientific evidence or any reasonable theories that would demonstrate that things can pop into existence from nothing? Well, no. So, it's safe to say that if something begins to exist, something caused it to exist. The universe began to exist. Now, why do you know that? Because it's not eternal. Okay, everything hasn't already happened yet. So the universe began to exist. Therefore, anything that begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist. Therefore, drum roll, it had a beginning. And we call the cause of the universe God. Okay, you can call the cause of the universe anything you want. We call that cause God. Now, why do we do that? Because whatever created the universe is absolutely, astoundingly, incredibly powerful. Last week, part of the presentation that Bill gave, you saw a comparison of the sizes of some of the different stars in our galaxy. And he commented that there's about 100 billion, I forget the number now, stars in our galaxy. And there are 100 billion galaxies in the known universe. And we don't know how big the universe is. It's big. There's a lot of stuff here. It all operates according to an amazingly detailed, complex set of rules. Physics calls those the laws of physics. Everything operates according to those rules. Incredibly powerful that created this. Incredibly knowledgeable, because whoever created this had to have a plan, had to figure out how to get everything to lay together just right so that this universe, once it's here, would continue to operate and process and have a place in it where there can be a world with life on it. That takes an incredible amount of knowledge, wisdom, intelligence, understanding. This creator has to be personal. And by that I mean this creator has to have free will. Because whatever caused the universe had to be able to choose to make the universe pop into existence. Because if it was just some mechanical operation, then something had to cause that non-thinking mechanical operation to pop the universe into existence. So whatever triggered everything has to be personal. Has to have a free will to be able to make choices, has to be incredibly powerful, has to be incredibly knowledgeable. And there's a whole bunch of other attributes that people lay on to what it would have taken to create the universe. But that's enough to give you a sense of what we're talking about here. God caused the universe. Well, some people say, well, what about the multiverse, that there's multiple universes? The multiverse model says that our universe is just like a little soap bubble in a bathtub full of soap bubbles. And as you stir the water, more bubbles pop up, and those are independent universes, and that's where everything comes from, is from this multiverse. Well, that's nice. There are as many competing theories about the multiverse as there are bubbles in your bathtub. Okay, there are a lot of them. There are a lot of them. Now, what's interesting about all of these theories is that most of them are really just desperate scrambling ideas to try and put something out there that says that multiverses are what caused our universe. However, if you look at those that are the subset that seem to be possible, that is, that don't have internal logical contradictions, that they're self-consistent, that they don't incur circular logic or whatever. You throw away all of those and you have very few left. And those theories that are left all have a trait in common. And that is that they have to be expanding. Our universe is expanding. The multiverse, if there is a multiverse, it has to be expanding, because all the other theories about multiverses fall apart if they are not expanding, and I can't give you the reasons behind that. But that, yes, Paul. Whoops, microphone.
So isn't the multiverse just another attempt to try to create infinity or eternality, like endless? Oh, sorry.
No, it's a perfect question.
Going? Okay.
It's a great question. The multiverse is exactly that. It is an attempt to get out of this issue of the universe that we're in need to having a beginning. However, these guys whose names I can't pronounce, Bord, Guth, and Vilenkin. Look, I didn't name them. Don't blame me. Any universe or multiverse that is on average expanding had a beginning. And everything that science tells us about our universe is that it is expanding, which therefore means it had a beginning. All of the theories about multiverses that seem to be consistent say they have to, if they exist, by the way, that's a key question, if they exist, they have to be expanding, which means they had to have a cause. So all the multiverse does is move the question about who started everything back one step. That's all it does. And every theory, again, every theory that uses multiverses to get away from an origin of our universe is stuck, because they still have to say who started the multiverse. It requires a personal agent to start the universe. We have a question over here.
So then, what is the, I guess, take on the Big Bang Theory? Right, that's where the scientific community comes in and says.
So, what's the take on the Big Bang Theory?
Sure.
What I'm presenting here are the non-Christian theories of where everything came from, and science says the universe started in a Big Bang. It launched from something, and expanded and grew and matured into what we have now. That's what science says. That's what astronomers say. But I'm not sure if I'm addressing your question directly.
So I guess from a scientific community standpoint, that's their beginning, right? That's going to be their argument. That's where they're going to say that's the beginning. But it kind of goes to what would be the cause of that.
What would be the cause of that? Science doesn't know. The short answer is, because here's the deal. You come to this point of saying, look, something that has the ability to make a choice pushed the universe into existence, that launched things. They say, well, it was a multiverse. Well, what launched the multiverse? That multiverse launcher, what is that? Oops. I thought I had a slide that said God. I'm sorry. They don't have an explanation. So when someone is using this line of reasoning with you, you come up to the point with them and they say, okay, we don't know what will cause this to happen, but we're pretty sure science will find out. There's a very interesting statement by a physicist out of South Africa who studies cosmology, the origin of the universe, and his comment is that we have just about learned everything that we can learn about the origin of the universe, because to learn more, to get more data about how things started, requires such huge laboratory instruments that we really can't afford to build them. There's a superconducting super collider in Europe that is, I think, 17 miles around, something like that. But to get to the next level, this physicist, Green is the last name, says that we really need one that's closer to 1,700 miles in diameter to generate sufficient velocities and energies to look at the next layer of what might be there in the universe. So his argument is science is pretty much at the end, unless there's a drastic change, at the end of what they can discover about where the universe came from. And he's also one who went from atheist physicist to Christian as he studied the origins of the universe. Was one of the things that pushed him into this direction, saying, there's got to be a beginner. There's got to be someone for the Big Bang. Someone lit the fuse. And that one is God. Okay, so there is no scientific answer to where the universe came from. They're still looking, and that's cool. You get lots of interesting data about stars and galaxies and stuff, and you get some of the most gorgeous pictures as astronomers look into our universe. I had a question with Mary. Just a second. Wait for the microphone.
Do you think that's maybe why they decided that they would continue to almost solely teach our kids at school the theory of evolution over the Big Bang theory, even though most scientists agree that it started with the bang?
Two separate questions. We're going to talk about evolution here in a little bit. But the question of origin of the universe is, astronomers are much easier to get along with than biologists in this realm, because a lot of astronomers will tell you, we don't know. And they entertain the strangest theories and say, let's give them a shot. Lay them out there. Let's debate them and discuss them and tear them apart. Maybe they will help us think about things differently and we'll learn something new. So astronomers are very open to people proposing the most bizarre theories for how the universe came into existence. And then they go to conferences and meetings and get grants to study them. And they come up and say, oh, I don't know. They keep coming back to the same point over and over again. Now, the origin of life is the next step. You have a universe. Now we have planets. Where did life come from? The question, of course, is how do you get life from non-life? How do you get life from a rock? How do you go from non-living material to living, breathing organisms? What do you need for life? Now, this goes into the biological realm. Because now you're talking to biologists who have an agenda. A lot of them have an agenda. And it's a sad one. But what do you need for life? There's some basic things that any living organism, excluding viruses, we're struggling. Biology still doesn't know what to do with viruses. Are they alive? Are they not? Are they more like a computer program that needs a computer that they stick into to run to become alive? There's a lot of question about viruses. So ignoring viruses, what do you need for life? You need a boundary. You need a spot that says, this is outside and this is inside. There has to be a boundary between the rest of the world and this living whatever it is. You need a way to store and use information. And that's important because of everything else that that living thing has to do. There has to be some instructions that it has to be able to follow, and it has to store those instructions in some way and be able to pass them on to its offspring. You need a way to get food in. Organisms eat. You need a way to produce energy. It doesn't make any difference if you get something in if you can't do anything with it. You've got to be able to digest the food. You've got to be able to produce energy, digest the food. You've got to be able to make repairs because everything breaks. Living organisms are constantly repairing themselves. That's just the way it goes. You've got to have a way to make repairs. You've got to have a way to get rid of the trash. And you've got to have a way to reproduce. From the simplest cell to people, there has to be a way to replicate yourself or everything comes to an end. Now, that's a pretty good list. All of these things have to happen before you can have something that's alive. Now, so how do you get life from non-life? The Miller-Urey experiment is a classic. It was started in 1952. Okay, it's been around a while. But still, when you look in textbooks and you're in discussions about where did life come from, this experiment is still one of the first things that they reference that showed that you can get life from non-life. And here's the experiment. They said, let's take some water that has a stuff in it we think was around in the early Earth, and we'll gently warm it so that a little evaporation goes on there. And we'll put over here some water and some methane and some ammonia and some hydrogen that they think made up the early atmosphere. And then we'll run sparks through it on occasion, because that's lightning that was in that early atmosphere. And we're going to get cool stuff out. And then they condense it out, and down here they stick in a pipette and slurp some out, and they put it into an instrument and find out what we got. So what did they get? This experiment actually generated more than 20 different amino acids. Okay, an amino acid is basically a building block of life. everything that's alive, excluding those crazy viruses who actually also have amino acids in them, but I'm not sure what else is there. Amino acids are those fundamental molecules that make up all living things. And there's about 50 different kinds that a human needs. This experiment generated over 20, but it didn't generate the rest, but that's okay. A human being can generate those other 30. If you have those 20 amino acids in your diet, your body can make the missing ones, and it's okay. But your body can't make, there's a fundamental 20 that your body can't make. But so this experiment generated a bunch of amino acids that are the building blocks of life. And when this research was published, man has created life in the laboratory. Okay, because we have found out how it was done. Because this experiment generated some of the building blocks of life. Now, but what's that really like? You see, if you build just those amino acids, if you build those different molecules, that's really like getting most of the raw building material that you need for a house driven to the lot where your house is going to be built. You get lumber, cement, nails, screws, drywall, paint, all of the stuff that you need to build a house. That's what the Uri Miller experiment gives you. It gives you those pieces. We're there, right? Man, Mark's not here. Question, which is more work, to get the parts, to get the assemble, the raw material to the building site, or to have a building appear? Basically, how do you get a house from that pile of stuff? The Uri Miller experiment demonstrated a way to get the raw materials for the house, but it didn't say anything about how to take those pieces and actually turn it into a house. So, biologists, being very, very bright people, said, okay, there must be a better answer. So we'll dig deeper and we'll come up with other ideas. One idea is very simple. It's you take the Uri Miller experiment and you add clay. And they say, okay, inside of those tiny layers of clay, those molecules that were created live. And they are there close together, and they start to react together, and they start to build bigger and bigger molecules, and poof, life comes out. Now, the details, I read the summary of one of these papers, and the detailed description is about 12 pages, but what it really says is what I just told you. When you cut away all the scientific verbiage, what you really get down to is these molecules sat next to each other and poof, they connected together and something cool happened. That's really what it says. Another theory was, well, you take the Uri Miller experiment kind of stuff, creating those molecules, but you create them in a deep sea vent because they're warm. They're in the ocean where there's all this other material floating around, so it's nice and warm, and these molecules are formed, and how do you get from those basic molecules? Let's go on. Because, again, then the miracle happens. Okay? So it says, well, gee, life really originated under ice caps because, you know, if these molecules are very hot, they break down. So they have a very short life. So you can't keep them very warm or they break down. So, but if you do the Uri Miller experiment and it's cold, then you can get your molecules under the ice caps, away from sunlight, because sunlight will break these things down really fast. And it slows reactions down, so they have time to hang out next to each other, kind of chum up, chat a little bit, and say, hey, come on, you want to link up and let's go talk, you know? How do you get from those basic molecules to something bigger? Well, let's go on. Because they don't have an answer. I like this theory. Well, RNA, a simpler molecule, was formed first, and then we formed the more complicated ones. But how did you form that first one? Let's go on. Really, what happened is this. Life formed from very simple molecules, and those simpler molecules got more complicated, and they got more complicated, and they got more complicated, and poof, you got life. Is there anything missing from that explanation? Oh, I forgot this one. This is my favorite. aliens did it. You know, I poke and fun, but to the real, these guys, there are some really serious researchers trying to ask, how do you get life if there's God is not in the picture? Okay, I'll come back to that in just a second. But one argument is that these Uri Miller experiment molecules come down on meteorites, and they land on the Earth, and they land in that warm pool or whatever, and then they start to cozy up to each other, and they start to react, and poof, great things happen. Or they say, well, maybe life itself came on an asteroid, and that seeded the Earth with life, and it went from there. Okay, well, if life came on an asteroid, then where did the life get started that was on the asteroid? You have the same question, you just moved it back a level. Okay. And so all of these origin of life scenarios have one incredibly fatal flaw that biologists really struggle to admit, and that is this. Every scenario requires a designer and an architect and a builder. It requires a blueprint. It requires lots of creativity to be able to actually go from those simple building blocks into something you could call life. Every one of them has a fatal flaw of they get to the spot where you have the bricks for the building, and then they say, then a miracle happened, and you have life out the other end. That every one of them has that exact same approach to the definition, to the description. They just don't use those words. But underneath, what they're really saying is, between the building materials and the finished house, I have no idea what went on there, but I know it wasn't God. Where did people come from? Where did people come from? That's a great question. The answer, if you're a scientist, is very trivial. We evolved, and we know that. Let's take a look at that just briefly. One of the fascinating things is that if you pay attention to this stuff at all, over the past 10, 15 years, there have been an amazing number of different kind of hominids, potentially pseudo-human critters that walked around on two legs. They discovered a lot of these in different parts of the world, and every time they discover a new one of these critters, they take this family tree and they have to shuffle it all around, because you got a new creature, it's got to fit in here somewhere. How does it fit? Well, when I was a lot younger than I am now, we had, I think it was Australopithecus. That's this guy down here. And there was an argument that Australopithecus went up to Homo erectus, who became a Neanderthal, who became a person. And then they found another skull and other parts of some different critter and said, oh, hey, we found this Homo habilis. This one I remember very well. Homo habilis, when he was discovered. Oh, so this Australopithecine, I can't even say it, this dude became a Homo habilis, and he became a Neanderthal, and he became a person. And then they found another one. Oh, man, they found Homo heidelbergensis. This was just 5 years ago or so when I first started seeing this. This guy messed everybody up. Says, well, when we study this guy and Homo erectus are not very well related, so they can't be on the same line. So Homo erectus is out. You're out. You lost out. You know, you got kicked off the island. But Homo heidelbergensis then, and Neanderthals, and then people. But then they found some DNA from Neanderthals, and they sequenced the DNA from Neanderthals. And guess what? Neanderthals aren't people. Neanderthals aren't people. You know that because when they do the studies, they can say this piece of DNA is Neanderthal, this piece of DNA is human, and if they were really the same creature, they couldn't tell that. But they can tell there's a distinct difference between the DNA. So Neanderthals are not people. They're not human. They're not. These Neanderthal have a different DNA. They are not from human beings, and they are not on the path to human beings. So then they said, well, oh, it must go from heidelbergensis to Homo sapiens. Okay. St- stay tuned, because this is like one of those soap operas. The next chapter will be coming soon on where they shuffle the lines next. The point is, if you have a theory that's pretty close to right, when you get a new piece of data, it should fit into your theory without a lot of twisting and turning to make it fit, if you're really kind of on the right path. But it seems like every time they find a new critter, they have to totally shuffle how all these guys relate to each other, which means they don't really know how they fit together. They really don't, but that's not the worst problem. I like this one. This is great. If you follow DNA studies, and I know I'm a geek and I do that sort of thing, all men seem to be descended from one person, one man. The genetic DNA evidence points to a single male ancestor. All women are descended from one woman. And that's interesting and that's cool, but this one really drives science nuts. Evolution requires a population. Let me illustrate it this way. Let's say you want to breed dogs, and you buy two dogs, male and a female, Siberian Husky, because I think they're beautiful. And you breed those two together, and you take their offspring, and luckily you get a mix of males and females in the litter, and you let them grow up, and you breed them together. And you let them grow up and breed them together, just staying within this group that you've started with from this original two dogs. What happens about three or four generations down? Do you know? Sorry? I can't hear you. I'm sorry. Inbreeding. What happens when you inbreed? They're not viable. When you inbreed too much, you get weird results. They're not viable. The line dies out. If you start, evolution says, by the way, humans have been around for 150,000 years or 100,000 years or whatever. You know, pick a number. Three or four generations downstream, your offspring start to be so inbred that you start to build up so many genetic defects that they are not viable. They die. They're weak. They have all sorts of health problems. So science says all three of these things are true. Is there a problem? Yeah. On the one hand, they say, oops. On the one hand, they say one man, one woman started it, but on the other hand, they say you have to have a population, and that population, last I read, had to be somewhere around 1,000 people at least to give a reasonable, healthy population later on. 1,000 people would have quite genetically different before you could have a good population going forward. So there's a problem here. Well, that's not the only problem. Yes, Josh. So
have they ever had an instance where basically evolution came about and this animal was created through evolution, and then, because you have to have a male and a female,
yes,
to reproduce. It just doesn't work otherwise with humans. So,
or with most other creatures, but you're right.
That means that had to have a male produced from evolution and then a female as well.
Mm-hmm.
Not only at the same time,
but in the same place, because they got to meet each other.
But then, have they ever recorded an instance where it was even possible for animals with mutations or whatever to reproduce together if they had a similar mutation?
If two critters have the same mutation get together, their offspring will all have that same mutation, because that's kind of way how genetics works. But I think, let's follow on here just a little bit, and I'll address, you're steering in the direction I'm headed. So a guy named Stephen Jay Gould looked at how evolutionary theory works and the scientific data that supports evolution and all of that. And he said, the only thing that makes sense, as I look at the fossil record as well, is that there are long periods of time where there's just no change. And there's a short period of time where there's a dramatic amount of change. And then there's a long period of time where there's no change, short period of time where there's dramatic change. And the fossil record, if you look at the fossil layer, shows this very well, that there's fossils, all of a sudden an explosion of new kinds of fossils. And then you see in the fossil record where those kinds, some of them kind of die out even, and maybe a new one appears, yeah, sort of. But for the most part, some of them die out, but no major changes for a long time. And then something explodes, happens, and you get a whole new kind of critters through this really, really fast evolutionary change to a new level of creatures. That was wonderful. And they called that punctuated equilibrium. And Stephen Jay Gould wrote a lot of papers and did a lot of research and all this. But there's no mechanism that works. There is no known way to have this dramatic change. Josh asked, how can you get this to happen? Do you restate your question again, Josh? I'm with the mic. Yeah.
Well, I said evolution requires that you would have to have both the male and the female. And they not only would have to have been made at the same time in the same place, but they would also have to have the same mutation to where they could have viable offspring.
Yes, they would have to, if they're both different from their parents, they would have to have the same kind of set of changes so that they together could make viable offspring with that new set of changes. And that is the problem that is what Stephen Jay Gould said, there is no mechanism for that to happen. There is no known way, from what we know of biology, for you to have a dog have some mutations in that mother's womb that delivers a litter of puppies that have some sizable differences that then are still viable, that then could find some other dog who had offspring with the same kind of changes that could breed together and start a new population with enough variation that you could actually progress through the radical changes that we see between life forms. It just doesn't happen. He could find no way to make that work. Same way with Darwinian evolution. And these two things go together. You see, things evolve. You realize that. And it also depends on the definition you use for the word evolve. But things change over time. The average human is taller now than they were a couple generations ago. That's change. They change. Evolution, change over time, that's a change. But you realize that a better way to describe that is adaptation. That is when, okay, step into my theological shoes for a minute. When God came up with this process, he realized that if human beings were too rigid in their genetic makeup, they would be very susceptible to diseases, to droughts, to famines, etc. And so he designed people with the ability to adapt to their local climate. That's why you have people who can live at the equator and why you have people who can live up at the Arctic Circle. Okay, and everywhere in between. There is adaptation that happens, and that is all within the realm of the design that was put into place. Adaptation is not evolution Adaptation or microevolution, small changes that allow you to adjust to the kind of environment you live in. That's microevolution, that's adaptation. We see it all the time. Macroevolution, how do you go from, a wolf to a whale? Which, by the way, is one of the evolutionary success stories, but it has some real problems. There is no mechanism that allows the kind of changes that need to be made to happen, because inside of your body is a lot of checks and balance mechanisms that say, this cell doesn't look right. I'm going to get rid of that one. In the uterus, when embryos are developing, there's processes, this is not a viable one. I need to get rid of that one. And they die. There are processes designed into the way we are made to keep us from delivering radically different offspring. It's designed into our biology. It's there. And biologists use that all the time to be able to do all sorts of fun research and stuff, knowing that this is the process. This is what happens. Is God has built into us a self-regulatory system to keep us within a range of healthy variation. And to go outside of that is impossible for the organisms. There's no way to make that happen. Now, people keep trying to come up with ideas, but they haven't. Again, science has no answer. Punctuated equilibrium, Darwinian evolution, the wonderful neo-Darwinian synthesis, whatever labels you want to put on it. When you dig down to the bottom, science has no explanation for where people came from. Josh.
So when you talk about microevolution, you reach a point where a new species is created, and therefore the definition of a species would determine that this new species shouldn't be able to breed with the old one.
It goes back to the definition of species. Here's an example of speciation. If you have a forest and some energy crew decides to rip out a mile-wide stretch through the forest and run this whole pile of high-energy electric poles through that forest, you have birds on one side and birds on another. Now, if they're forest birds, they might not fly a mile to get into the other forest. By one definition of species, you have just created a new species just by separating them from being able to interbreed. In the old days, the definition of a species was two organisms that could no longer interbreed and have viable offspring was called different species. Donkey and horse. You get mules. Very few mules can breed successfully. So donkeys and horses are different species, and mules are this weird hybrid. Okay, you could never end up with a population of mules breeding out there by themselves. It won't happen. So the definition of species has been kind of modified over time to make it easier to see speciation happen, because that better supports the story that is told from biology to say that evolution happens. So you got to be real careful of definitions. But the bottom line is, seriously, science doesn't have an answer of where we came from. And they keep working and working and looking, and they're spending a lot of money trying to figure this out. And that's cool. We find a lot of neat things. Comments? Vanessa?
All of this just amazes me to the power of a creator and how much time is spent trying to disprove that power. I think it all goes a credit to Satan's power and how much he has a control in that, the dark side.
Well, you know, what's cool is that all of these people trying to figure out find a way to do all these things without God, they keep running up against the wall, but they can't go any farther. And what's cool is that you find on occasion biologists who give it up and say there had to be a designer. You find astronomers that say there had to be a designer. So there are some who take a look at their own research and they finally have to say, you know, we can't get where we want to get from here. There's got to be something in between the pieces, the building materials, and the house. That's got to be God. And there are some who are, you know, by the way, I mentioned this before. I think this is really cool. Stephen Hawking, you know, Stephen Hawking, you heard the name, the brilliant cosmologist. He's going to church on occasion because he wants some answers and he can't find them. And so he's talking to some church people. So, you know, even the hardest of hearts, given the right circumstances, can be turned to ask, God, are you really there? And what we want to do, part of this, is to try and give you the understanding that there are answers. Some of the questions are hard and the answers are complicated, but there are answers that says that, yes, when you get to the end of your searching, there is an answer. The real answer is Jesus Christ. And that's where you want to get people to. It's cool to find Stephen Hawking wondering if there's a God. What I want to hear about is Stephen Hawking wondering if there's a savior. Because knowing there's a God is nice. Okay, that's kind of cool intellectually. Knowing there's a savior means he's joined the family. And everything that we do needs to be focused on helping people to join the family. Because without Christ, all of this wonderful science and debates and discussions are not worth anything unless we realize that we're trying to bring people home to Christ, where they'll be together with God for eternity.